This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome. The end is near. We are less than a week from Election Day. We have come to learn so much about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. We do not know nearly as much about the voters, and David Domke thinks you should pay more attention to them. Domke chairs the Department of Communications at the University of Washington. He says voters have changed in the last 20 years in two big election-affecting ways, religious beliefs and racial diversity.
It was 80 to 90% white for decades and decades, and now we expect about 70% white in this presidential election. And African Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans, Natives are all at larger percentages than they have ever been in our country's history in the presidential electorate. And that would not matter except that the people of color, the voters of color, vote differently in general than white voters.
How so?
That's important.
Our listeners might assume they know how so, but I don't know.
Sure.
Well,
the African Americans have been the most dedicated Democratic Party voters for decades. That continues. Latino Americans have been split over time, but have in the last couple elections swung strongly towards the Democrats. Asian Americans actually were more Republican back in the late 1980s and were split in 1992 over Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush, but also have swung dramatically Democratic. Native American voters are strongly Democratic. So what you have is a strong Democratic coalition now that is what has been called kind of the Obama or the emerging America coalition that is much more Democratic, much less white, whereas white voters tend to be about 60-40 Republican.
Except the Republican and Democratic parties are changing, too. And we have, you know, the candidates that aren't like other candidates. So how do you think race plays into this election?
Well, you know, in some really kind of unusual ways, Republicans, if you looked at their top candidates, are offering a much more diverse field in this presidential election. You go back 15 months. They're much more diverse than what the Democrats are offering.
Are you talking presidential or nationwide?
No, but even if you look in governor's seats around the country, there are more women, more non-white candidates that are Republican than Democrats. But when you look at the voting composition of the electorate, and that's driven more by policies than by the people at the top of the tickets, the Democrats draw much more strongly among voters of color.
We're getting early voting results showing a falling turnout among African-American voters compared to last year. Is that just lack of Obama effect, or what do you think's going on?
Yeah, I think that is getting attention. I think there's two things going on there. One is we have to expect a bit of a fall off from the first African-American identified president. So a bit of that. At the same time, I think there's a reasonable point to be made that maybe the Democratic Party or the Clinton campaign has not satisfactorily reached out or kind of in a positive way targeted African-American voters with their policies. And they're working hard on that now, but we'll see. And this could matter in some key states.
How would Clinton's campaign reach out to African-American voters more?
Well, there could have been some economic policies that would have been more accentuated. Think about some of the younger voters, many of color, that Sanders was able to draw in the Democratic primary. So, you know, we have a generational shift here in that older African-American voters very much prefer Clinton, but younger, they were pretty strongly Sanders. So some economic policies. She was later to the process of thinking about some criminal justice reform. The reality is that some of her kind of positions around trade or healthcare might not be as strongly as some African American voters might want. So I think there are some things there that maybe they would go back and do retrospectively, because they might have been banking on just the way in which Trump pushed away these voters.
What's happening to the so-called religious vote in this country?
From the late 1960s through really 2005 or 6, white evangelicals were the dominant religious force in this country. They dominated the messages and the debates, and they were the group that turned out so strongly for the Republicans that they were the crucial voting bloc. Mitt Romney, 38% of voters for Mitt Romney in 2012 were white evangelicals. Okay, but what has happened, I really think, is that the racial changes in this country have brought along religious changes as well.
People, how's that?
Well, you have immigrants coming to this country who bring different traditions. You also have a reality that Hispanic Catholics are different than white Catholics. Okay, so Hispanic Catholics tend to be a bit more liberal than white Catholics, and so we have some movement among kind of religious groups, and we also have this really burgeoning body of people that are called the nuns. That's N-O-N-E.
That's not N-U-N-S. Right.
No, it's the...
Far from it.
Yeah, N-O-N-E, which are people who in surveys say, I believe in God in some capacity, but I'm not, I have no religious affiliation whatsoever. So they're called the nuns. And they've gone from, you know, 4 to 6% in the mid-1990s to over 20% of our population now. And so they might be mostly Christian in general, but they don't think and act politically like evangelicals or kind of conservative Catholics. And so what we've got is a much more pluralistic religious arena so that no single voice dominates in religious terms now.
Is it clear how the nuns will vote this election?
The nuns have been highly Democratic for the last several elections. So it's likely they tend to be younger. They also tend to be more open-minded, which correlates generally with a kind of Democratic position. But that youngerness, again, is a struggle for Clinton. She has struggled with younger voters in a way that Obama did not struggle with younger voters.
There's been a lot of talk about how religious voters could or could not support Donald Trump. What's the actual reality? Do we know how much he attracts religious voters?
This is the $10 million question for this election is how do white evangelicals who have made the case for decades that their positions are principled ones based upon a morality framework that has to do with policy positions around abortion and same-sex relationships, but also has to do with the notion of fidelity in relationships, sexual kind of approaches, all kinds of things. How could they endorse and support this person? Well, the rationale that has been put forward by those who do, and there are plenty in the religious right who still do support him, is that we don't support the man, but we support the policies that he would nonetheless endorse, and that he'd be better than Clinton on those. And for example, they'd rather have him appoint Supreme Court justices than Hillary Clinton. In my view, I think that white evangelicals have lost tremendous credibility in this election, in that they had a chance to make a kind of definitive principled statement in this case that, yeah, we care about these policies, but we care about who we pull the lever for, too. And I think that they would have come out of this in much stronger terms politically and in credibility wise if they would have said, this isn't our election. This isn't us. We're just not going to vote because we don't want to vote for Clinton either. Right. But they did.
Why does their credibility matter to anybody but them?
I think it matters in terms of policymaking on Congress, so they have less influence. I think it matters in terms of the ability to make a moral argument for this country about any position on any issue. So the credibility doesn't just matter in terms of getting someone elected. It matters in terms of neighbors. It matters in terms of advancing a certain moral framework that they care about.
We've been talking about Christians, affiliated and unaffiliated. What about other religions in this country?
Sure. So, Muslim Americans, of course, have gotten a great deal of attention this election, often negative from Donald Trump, hostile. And the reality is that I think that many Muslim Americans come out of this election with that kind of credibility I'm talking about, the way that they've handled themselves as a group, the way that some of their leadership has taken principled positions. So I would say that increasing diversity among Muslims, the nuns, the Buddhists and the Hindus, Mormons, I think all of them come out of this election with a greater political credibility. I think Mormons in Utah have taken the stand against Trump that white evangelicals could have taken. They did it because they said he doesn't represent us. We won't vote for this guy. I mean, I respect that.
Looking beyond this election, does more religious and racial diversity in this country equal more Democrats in office?
It likely does. That's the way the coalitions are set up right now. History tells us, though, that political parties do evolve and do...
They don't last in irrelevancy, right? They evolve.
Right. They evolve because they have to. And there's tremendous power involved in these parties, right? So I think that they will evolve. I would be of the mind that the 2020 presidential nominee for the Republicans will be pro-immigration reform, will be at least neutral on same-sex relationships, and will have a much more welcoming, racially inclusive platform. And I think that they could have been closer to that with a Marco Rubio or a John Kasich in this election, both of whom are definitely conservative, but are not hostile to racial and religious minorities. And so I think that the 2020 nominee is likely to be that. However, I'm not sure the Republican Party will be the same Republican Party then.
How much of you, Professor, thinks Donald Trump could win the presidency?
7%.
Do you take it seriously?
Yeah. I think anybody who's one of the two finalists, basically we have two Super Bowl finalists here, and things can happen when the game is played. People don't turn out. You don't know what's going to happen. So if you're in the ring, another metaphor, if you're in the ring, then you can win. I don't think that there's any indicators that suggest that Trump is going to win, but there's that chance. Yeah.
The latest controversy about with the FBI and Clinton emails, not a game changer.
It's not a game changer, not for those people that are already set and who they're going to vote. There is a small slice of the electorate, independents, maybe waffling moderate Republicans who will be pushed away by this. In a primary, in the Democratic and Republican primaries, there's great movement in the polls and among the candidates all the way up to election day, because these are pretty similar apples to apples comparisons. And so you can move from A to B. In a general election, we're talking apples and oranges generally. At this point, the voting preferences are largely baked in. In fact, they've already been done in many states. About 30 million people have already voted, 30 million out of 130 million who will probably vote. The reality is I don't think it changes the equation dramatically. It tightens things, but Clinton's lead moves from 6 and 7 points to 4 to 5.
Trump is going to get a lot of votes.
Yeah.
Millions and millions of votes. What happens to Trump voters if he loses?
A large percentage of them will not be happy and will fight the system and will, in the worst case scenario, lead to some kind of actual rebellion. And I don't think that that's out of the realm of possibility, because I think that what happens after November 8th is far less known than what I think is likely to happen on the election day.
A rebellion, I mean, you mean a fight here, a fight there. You don't mean an organized revolt, do you?
Not organized in that there's somebody directing it, but organized in that there's a similar ideology, similar set of values that are driving it. So I don't think that the rebellion against that we saw in Oregon against the anti-militia is out of the question in many places. And it's not just the West, right? He could win Ohio. I think that those voters are absolutely the unknown after this election, what they're going to do and what Donald Trump does and what Republican leadership, not named Donald Trump, do really matters in that space. And so I desperately want a robust, principled Republican Party for our country. We need this, and we're going to need them starting November 9th in a dramatic way.
David Domke is chair of the Department of Communications at the University of Washington. Now, let's say more about who votes in this country. America has more prisoners than any other nation. You can't vote while you're in prison, and millions of people can't vote even after they get out of prison. But in 2009, Washington State restored that right to vote. What does that mean to people who are voting this year for the first time? KUOW's David Hyde spoke with two of them.
You know how you get your ballot in the mail and maybe you throw it in with a pile of fall catalogs or bills and voting? Oh, yeah, I got to get to that. Well, that's not what it's like for Susan Mason. She anticipated her ballot this year.
I waited anxiously for that. And when I got it, it was a Saturday, and I filled it out on a Saturday and I mailed it that Saturday.
Mason is driven to vote this year because it's her first time. Back in 2002, she went to prison. She was convicted of theft to support a drug habit.
I found a drug that completely took me out. It was methamphetamines.
Her crime? Stealing people's mail.
I was terrible at it, too. I totally was terrible at it. I'm the worst criminal ever. And I was caught and I was convicted by the feds and I went to federal prison for it.
Mason served 15 months. She actually says it saved her life because it helped her get off drugs. But she wasn't completely free. With a criminal record, it's hard to find a place to live or a good job.
And so this idea that I am sentenced to a lifetime of unemployment or sentenced to a lifetime of substandard housing is preposterous to me. And I had no voice to do anything to change that.
But in 2009, Washington State restored the right to vote to people who have served their time and are no longer on parole. And Mason says now she has a chance to vote for candidates that will fight for her and people like her.
To lead a life that's better than what we've got going on now.
Durrell Green is also voting for the first time in his life this year. He was born in Tacoma and later moved to Bremerton with his mom after his parents divorced. And he says with a traumatic family life and serious money struggles at home.
I kind of decided when I was a teenager, like, that I was not going to grow up and be that type of an adult. And ways to get money that were out of the box were introduced to me. And so I started doing those things. I started robbing people.
He was 14. A few years later, he went to prison. The crime?
Reached under my mattress, grabbed my Glock 40, put in my waist, walked outside, got picked up, drove to a house, went in there, put a gun in their face, and robbed them.
The charge was armed robbery.
I ended up going to prison the same month that I turned 18.
And that meant he never voted. Durrell was released 3 years later in 2005, and this year he plans to vote for the first time.
I feel like a citizen again. Like, my rights really are almost all the way restored. I pretty much can do everything anyone else can do except own a gun right now. So that kind of feels cool.
But what does it mean to him to be voting in 2016 for the very first time?
Well, with this being my first year voting, it's like there's no turning back now. You know, it's like a different level of responsibility. You know, I take voting seriously. You know, it's a right, and it's a right that can be taken away from you. And, you know, whenever you have something that's been taken away, you learn how to appreciate it way more.
In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
If you want to vote and you're registered, there's still time, you know. You can put it in one of the ballot drop boxes around town, or your ballot's got to be postmarked before or on Election Day, which is, I think you know, it's this coming Tuesday. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke with a news update. President Obama says his administration is looking at ways to reroute an oil pipeline in North Dakota. As you know, Native American tribes and their allies are protesting this pipeline's construction. President Obama told the online news site Now This that government agencies will let the situation, quote, play out for several more weeks and determine whether or not this can be resolved in a way that I think is properly attentive to the traditions of First Americans. So it's hard to know how serious a resolve that is, but we'll keep following that. Meanwhile, today, North Dakota regulators are issuing a formal complaint that could result in stiff fines against the company building that Dakota Access Pipeline. Regulators say the company may have mishandled the reporting of Native American artifacts that were found along the route. We'll have an update on the situation this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. I'm glad you joined us on The Record today. It has now been 1 year since Seattle Mayor Ed Murray declared a state of emergency on homelessness. A lot has happened in that year. I asked Mayor Murray how much closer we are to a solution to the homelessness crisis.
Well, I think we've been able to increase the number of services we're providing by 40% in our funding, including the package we're sending to council right now. We're increasing and have increased shelter capacity by more than 10%. We're in the process of doubling our outreach to people who are homeless on our streets in this city. But having said that, the crisis in this city, in suburban towns in this state and throughout the West Coast continues to grow.
Let's talk about the city for now. Could Seattle just spend way more money on housing and trash and needle cleanup, on police patrols? Is it a matter of money here?
You know, part of it is an issue of money, but part of it is, you know, Seattle's not a bubble isolated from the rest of the country. People move here all the time. Most people are from somewhere else. Some people move here and lose their job and become homeless. Some people move here and are addicted. And end up on our streets. And so, you know, it's not just the idea that Seattle alone is in a bubble can solve a problem that exists in our suburban cities, exists throughout Western Washington, exists in Portland and San Francisco and Los Angeles.
Well, what you control is Seattle. Why not put a homelessness levy on the ballot and put more money at it?
I've actually talked about that, but I think one of the questions we have to ask ourselves, you know, we have seen almost half of federal money over the last 30 years for affordable housing and homelessness go away. We've seen addiction and mental health services cut at other levels of government. The question is Seattle now going to take on a responsibility in areas it hasn't traditionally taken on? Are we just going to say we've given up on the state? the county doesn't have any money because of its broken revenue model. The feds are done with helping cities and towns, and the cities and towns are all on their own. The answer to that may be, yes, that's America we live in today, and so each city is on its own to raise as much money as it can. But I don't believe, I think Seattle can be part of the solution, but at some point you need to ask the question, is this problem the creation of a single city, and so should that single city solve that problem? And I think the answer is clearly no. This is a national epidemic, and we can be partners in solving it, but we do need other levels of government to step up.
The neighborhood group Safe Seattle has described the unauthorized camping and sleeping out in the city and the crime that sometimes happen. They've used the word anarchy. What do you say?
So I agree. And I mean, I don't support unauthorized encampments, particularly in our streets and our sidewalks. We are moving in a way as humanely as we can to move people into services. And for those people who refuse to move, to simply move them out of areas they don't belong. It's not easy because, again, if you look at the roots of this crisis, let's take one example. 50% of the people who are addicted to opiates in this city, 50% are homeless. And if you look at our homeless encampments, early data indicates maybe as many as 80% of the people who are in those unauthorized areas where they're camping are addicted to opiates. When you have a growing national heroin epidemic, if we don't deal with treatment and an expansion of the treatment, and I really want to thank President Obama for having a huge ask in his budget, and I hope Congress passes it after next Tuesday. If we don't get that level of help, a city alone is not going to be able to get on top of this.
You have proposed, and there already are some authorized tent camps. As for unauthorized campers, some city council members say moving them from place to place just increases their hardship and doesn't solve the problem. What do you say?
Well, let's talk about an example, the area called the Greenbelt, sometimes called the jungle. What did we have in that unauthorized encampment, as we see in many? We had some of the most violent crime in the city. We had murders. We had rapes. We had human trafficking. And we went in there, and each individual was reached about 37 times, and folks were offered services. I think roughly, and I'm going to give you rough numbers here, about a third of the people, maybe a little less, actually took housing or services. The rest didn't. So when we're doing that level of outreach, and people won't move, and they're in an area that's dangerous for them, for the homeless, and in this case, the freeway was suffering some serious damage, and the state needs to work on it, then I do think we need to move people. I don't think that's moving people around.
What about places where there no one is in imminent danger? Can you let those people be?
Well, the question is, I'm not sure what areas you're talking about. I'll tell you, if we're talking about our parks and our sidewalks, I believe that's a mistake. You know, we have kids in the city who are poor enough that their experience of the outdoors, their chance to recreate, will be in our parks and in our community centers. I don't think we need to pit needs against each other. We are trying to identify land that's not being used, which is very hard in a growing city, that will be safer for folks who are homeless. But it's a challenge.
The city hired a national homelessness expert who said that authorized tent camps, she used the word unconscionable, because they delay the bigger solutions that you want. Do you believe her?
Oh, absolutely. That's why I hired her. And I think the most regrettable thing I have experienced since I've been mayor is we have now been told by outside experts, we've now been told by the Obama administration, that Seattle King County focuses on the wrong end of the system, and that is shelters. And, you know, if you have a council meeting on shelters, the place will be packed. If you have a meeting on actually funding the part of the system that works and starting to shift that funding there, the room will mostly be empty. So we as a city are involved in the wrong end of the conversation. And as a result of that consultant's recommendations and other recommendations we've received, we are changing how this city, in conjunction with the county, deliver services so that we can actually do something to bring the numbers of homeless down.
Those bigger solutions, housing, outreach, better tracking, those are also longer term solutions. What will homelessness look like in Seattle, say, in one more year?
Well, my hope is that at least, by the end of 2017, that we have housed the estimated 500 families that with school-age children, that we have housed at least those folks in the next year.
How long will your state of emergency continue?
Until people stop dying on the streets from being homeless. You know, I need to point out, you know, before I became mayor, there was a plan called the 10-year plan to end homelessness. And in that 10-year period, they had identified and they built every single unit that was identified at the beginning of that 10-year period to end homelessness. And at the end of that 10-year period, the problem was only worse. We are dealing with a series of issues here, from a lack of mental health treatment, a lack of addiction services, the income inequality crisis that is in every part of this country, the fact that almost every county in America has a housing affordability crisis. What we see on our streets is a symptom of a bunch of problems that we as a nation have not addressed.
Finally, Mayor, will you ask voters for more money for homelessness?
Well, it's a question that I think we need to consider. What if the federal government is unwilling to be our partner? What if there isn't a significant infusion of funds to the county from the state for mental health? Then I think we're going to have to ask ourselves, should we go out to the ballot and ask voters to pay for more services? You know, the county and the city together are the number third. We're number three in the money that we spend on homelessness in the nation after L.A. or New York. So I'm willing to look at that, but I think the bigger question we have to ask ourselves is are we as a nation willing to address the issues of affordability, of mental health, and of addiction? Or are we just going to continue to cut and let those programs atrophy?
That's Mayor Ed Murray taking stock of the state of emergency on homelessness that Seattle and King County declared 1 year ago. Now, you heard us there discussing putting a homelessness levy to voters. We're going to talk more about going to voters later today, because in Washington and other states, voters are deciding on gun measures, minimum wage, campaign finance, marijuana. So we'll talk about the trend of the ballot measure today on KUOW's All Things Considered. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I went into this next conversation thinking, you're not going to want to hear this because it has to do with death. But now I'm thinking maybe I was wrong. This is a conversation with Katrina Spade, who wants you to, instead of buying a cemetery plot or getting cremated, she wants you to consider letting your body decompose into soil so your loved ones can use that soil for something new. Katrina is the founder of the Urban Death Project. She told me she was inspired by something ranchers have done for years, composting dead livestock.
And the basic principle is you take a body, like a, say, an animal carcass, like a cow, that's died of natural causes, and you cover it with a high carbon material such as wood chips. And so the bodies, our bodies are high in nitrogen, wood chips are high in carbon. And as you probably know, that ratio is critical for composting.
Right. If you have a compost bin, you're familiar with that.
Yeah. So essentially what we're doing is creating the right environment for the beneficial bacteria and microbes to come and do what they would do anyway in nature.
There are centuries of history of us doing other things with bodies. So why would you want to recomposition?
You know, the history of the funeral industry is fascinating. The two most common methods of disposition, cremation and conventional burial, came to us out of sort of a mix of like historical happenstance and industry interest. They're not really meaningful to a lot of people anymore. And so on the one hand, they've been happening for a fairly long time. Cremation started up in this culture in the 1960s, and conventional burial started up just after the Civil War, the way we know it today, with embalming and caskets. On the one hand, that's not a very long time. On the other hand, it's something that we're used to, but there's no reason those have to be the only two options.
Well, what's wrong with the funeral industry?
Here's the thing about the current funeral industry. Number one, it's a for-profit industry for the most part, and really does rely on selling consumables and services to people during their most vulnerable time. So, you know, when you're grieving, you are, I read the study once, that grieving is like being inebriated. It's like being drunk. You can't make a decision. It's really hard to think clearly. You're clouded by the feelings of sadness and of losing someone. And that's the moment where you go into a funeral home and you're pressured to buy the fanciest casket to honor your loved one.
Yeah, I've been in that room full of caskets.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason that death care needs to be that way. We've set it up this way, we've accepted it as a culture, but there's no reason it has to remain.
Well, burial is still meaningful to some people, and for a lot of others, I thought cremation was the hipper thing to do. What's wrong with that?
Well, I'll say first that my baseline feeling is if you love conventional burial, you want to be embalmed and buried in a casket, by all means, go for it. This is about providing more options because so few people really want that. As for cremation, it's become the default. I think it's less that people love fire, for example, or the idea of ashes, than that they are interested in something that feels like a more sustainable option, is less complicated and less expensive.
And less fussy.
It's less fussy, but you know what? I've heard so many people say, when I die, don't make a fuss. But I have to push back because I think if there's any moment in our lives when we should make a fuss, it's probably when someone dies.
Yeah. So to people who think that, oh, you don't care about the funeral ritual, your idea of recomposing is very ritualistic.
Yeah. Well, so I started designing this idea not with the concept of composting humans, but actually with the question of what could our cities provide us in terms of spaces and ritual for this huge momentous event of death that we're doing a terrible job marking and having ceremony around. We don't really have guidance for grieving in this culture. And so the project began with the goal of creating new types of spaces in our cities that honor the dead and support the grieving. And then it just evolved in part because my friend called me to tell me about this amazing process of livestock composting. But the project has evolved to be both a system and a ritual.
And the ritual involves, so that it's I'm picturing a vertical like a tower, and you carry your loved one up a ramp, a circular ramp, up to the top and place him or her in the wood chips.
Yep.
Right? And then the body over time sort of filters down, well, like kind of like a compost bin. I get my compost from the bottom of the bin, mm-hmm. open it up at the bottom in a few weeks, and it's soil. Is that it?
That's pretty close. So what happened was we designed the system in the first place to be vertical because we were thinking about cities and land use and the fact that half of the world's population lives in cities now, and we can't give an individual grave to each person that dies. So we think, okay, it's obvious that this system, this ongoing process, should start with a vertical structure. And that bodies would be laid in on top, covered with wood chips, and over time as they decomposed and finished material is taken out of the bottom, you have this ongoing downward-moving process. And so then I thought, well, of course, ramps would be a beautiful way to bring the body to the top of the core. And so the ritual evolved from the practicality of the technical, which I think for me was one of the special things that happened was, okay, and now you've got the living, breathing, grieving, carrying the body, using their own energy, carrying this inert object, their loved one, to the top of the core. And by laying it into this bed of wood chips, are beginning its transformation. And that transformation actually creates a new type of energy. And so this kind of winding of a watch, if you will, where up and around the core is the winding, and then you've set in motion a new process, became the ritual.
You know, Katrina, I don't find human composting the least bit gross or weird, but we're unusual. I mean, why do you think most people want the casket and the embalming and the makeup or the scattering of the ashes?
All right, I've got two things to say to you about that. The first is that cremation just this year has surpassed conventional burial as the most popular form of disposition in the U.S. It was at basically zero in 1960. So over 60 years, we see it go from nothing to the most popular form in the U.S. In Seattle, I think the rate is something like 90% of people are cremated. So that is to say that conventional burial is pretty quickly losing its interest for people. And the other thing is where you just said, we're different. I like human composting, but probably no one else does. I like human composting.
You hear that a lot.
I hear that all the time. I can't tell you how many times people have said to me, well, I get it and I really love it and I would want that for my body, but no one else probably would.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair.
It's
anecdotal. So maybe it's just not that weird, you know?
It might not be. I have to be honest, like kind of everything we do with dead bodies is a little bit weird. We're not used to talking about that stuff. We're not used to seeing it. And so it's just all going to feel a little off.
But you don't see a future where we just, I mean, why have a shroud? Why not a naked body? There's all kinds of elaborate things we do for no real reason. We don't have to have even the whole ritual you're talking about. Couldn't you just, you know, roll the body under your tree?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. What we're proposing isn't just like, let's simply take care of the physical thing that is the dead human body. We've got a lot more that we're trying to bring to death care. And I guess that's part of the reason that the project has been able to be so successful this far and get people behind it is because it's bringing more than just a process.
You said you do want to give meaning to this passage. How does the recomposting process give us meaning or dignity or anything?
Well, I'm not religious, and neither is my family and most of my closest friends. And so the closest thing I have to a faith really has to do with nature somehow. For me, it's very comforting to imagine that after I die, I can rejoin the ecosystem in a sort of pure way, stop being human. So for me, there's just more meaning in decomposing naturally and being used again to grow life.
What do you want to grow?
That's a good question. I think something kind of prickly, like a nettle or like something sour, like, you know, limes or something like that.
Really?
What about you?
I'm not a pot smoker.
Oh, I've had a number of people say, I'm going to be marijuana.
Sure, understandable.
My buddies can smoke me up.
Yeah. I do like a little rosemary with my chicken.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. I wonder if you get this a lot. I feel calmed when I imagine this tower and my atoms filtering down and going into your lemon tree.
I think it is very calming for many people. I think that's what's been such a draw. It's comforting. It's also just a known entity. Okay, that's what will happen to me after I die.
How has your feeling about your death, our deaths, how's that changed?
We truly are all part of this cycle of life and death. And when you start to be able to accept that, it's a real freeing, I think. But since working on this project, I've realized that death can be quite beautiful and that working in it gives one a better appreciation of being alive.
Katrina Spade, I'm happy you're alive with me for now, and thanks for this conversation.
Thank you.
Katrina founded and now directs the Urban Death Project, and she's going to be testing it out. She's going to be testing it out at Washington State University, and who knows, maybe coming to a park near you. What do you think about it? Are you interested in composting your remains? How would you like your body to be used? I had trouble when she asked me that question. Let us know what you think. First of all, we're tweeting out a link to a video about the project because video comes in handy on this one. So follow us on Twitter at KUOW and let us know what you'd like to become of what's left. You can email us if you want, record@kuow.org. Thank you for being with KUOW's The Record 6 days before Election Day. We vote by mail in these parts, of course, so you can postmark that by Tuesday or put your ballot into one of the drop boxes around town, at which point, if you live in King County, your ballot will get inspected by someone like Paige McGrath. She's one of hundreds of elections employees who process voter ballots.
My name is Paige McGrath, and I work in signature verification. We look at every single signature on every single ballot that comes in. We do not open the ballots. The ballots come in either from Dropbox or through the mail, and they run through our sort machines. Those sort machines upload the signatures so we can compare the signatures that they have on file from registration to what they signed on the actual ballot. We never actually touch the ballots. The kinds of things we look at are flow of the signature, positioning of the letters, the strokes, pen strokes, where they might lift their pen and reset it back down, the spacing of the letters within the signature. Those are all kinds of things that we look for when we're looking at a signature. The signatures that need a second set of eyes on them go into a separate set of trays, and another group looks at those ones a second time to make sure that we didn't miss something, or they want to double check, research, send out letters. In my 6 years, occasionally a voter will choose to use a picture for their signature, and rather than a written signature. And if that's the one we have on file, it's not a problem. But sometimes their pictures change. So maybe they signed with a smiley face one time, and another time they decided to switch to stars. And in that case, we'd go ahead and send that to the challenge group to have them take another look and perhaps get another signature on file so that we can count that vote.
That was King County elections worker Paige McGrath. She talked with KUOW's Ruby DeLuna. King County's already gotten more than 300,000 ballots here with less than a week to go before Election Day. You think it's crazy here? Politics in South Korea are weird right now. The president replaced the prime minister. She's shaking up her cabinet, dealing with a widening abuse of power scandal that involves a secret advisor with ties to a mysterious religious cult. You'll hear all about it this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Let's keep talking about politics here and nearby. Our two presidential candidates have soured on free trade agreements, but not Canada. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau just signed a major trade deal. Let's welcome Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hi, Bill. Yeah, a trade deal. I know that's so last century, but we've never been trendy here in Canada. What can I say?
Is that right? This one's with the European Union, yeah. Vaughn. It sounds like it just drops almost all the tariffs between the EU and Canada.
Yeah, a lot of the tariffs and the non-tariff barriers. It's expected once the Europeans get around to approving it all, there's 28 European countries have to approve it, that it'll probably increase trade between Europe and Canada by about 20%. So it's a good deal for both sides. It's not as big a deal as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's not as big a deal as NAFTA, but our government attached a very high priority to it. Canada's very dependent on trade, and this was a chance to get a trade deal at a time when, as you note, Bill, the forces of globalization and free trade are under siege all over the place, including in your election.
Indeed. So you say Canada's dependent on trade. Have Canadians not lost jobs or wages to global trade the way we talk about here?
No, I think it's the other way around.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Canada is a very, very trade-dependent country. About a third of our GDP is one way or another related to trade. Now, a lot of that is raw materials, lumber from British Columbia, coal, but manufactured stuff, too. The auto pact with the United States, which has been in place since the 1960s, is important. So, no, it's a bipartisan issue here, generally supportive of trade. You do get some Trump-style objections being raised by some of the trade unions, but the biggest hurdle was NAFTA, and that was cleared, you know, more than 20 years ago. And generally now, most analyses of the Canadian economy suggest that Canada did pretty well off NAFTA, even if it's controversial in the United States.
Is Canada looking at this souring on free trade deals in the U.S. and thinking, we better not rely too much on America?
Yeah, because much of the Canadian economy and the Canadian trade is so dependent on the United States, you're right, Bill. I think that's increased a sense of urgency at the national level. I mean, the The Export Development Canada, which is one of our big operations that looks at exports, has put out a report warning that either presidential candidate in the United States is more protectionist than we've had to deal with in the past. Democrats have always been protectionist in our experience. Republicans were free traders until Donald Trump came along. So I'd say there's a fair amount of anxiety at our national government level. We saw our trade minister, Chrystia Freeland, actually get choked up at a press conference a little over a week ago where it looked as if the negotiations with Europe were going sideways. It was like she recognized the stakes for Canada. That we got that back on the rails. It looks as if CETA will clear all the European parliaments next year. But, yeah, I mean, there's a real concern here that whatever happens next Tuesday, we're in for a rougher ride on trade. The agreement to manage the softwood lumber trade between Canada and the United States, 10-year deal, that expired in mid-October, and the general feeling up here is we're looking at trade action on lumber from the American lumber industry and not much sympathy from whoever wins the presidential election.
But I assume overall Canada's rooting for Clinton over Trump?
Oh, yeah, we tend to be Democrat. You know, middle of the Canadian political spectrum is a bit to the left, so... Yeah, you talk to Democrats up here, and the most they'll say is blue dog Democrat, you know, which is about as far left as they go. My paper, The Sun, did a piece this past week. The Democrats abroad in Vancouver have booked three bars in downtown Vancouver to watch the election returns next Tuesday night. So in the interest of balance, Bill, we tried to get a hold of Republicans abroad. They're based in Toronto, and they haven't posted anything on their website since about 4 days after the party in the United States picked Trump. So Republicans abroad keeping a low profile in Canada.
How do Canadians feel about being the place Americans promise to go if their candidate loses?
It's kind of flattering, although, you know, Americans talk about this all the time, and I see Bryan Cranston is out there this past week saying he's definitely going to move to Canada if Trump wins. Americans talk about this all the time, but the fact is, you know, if you look at it historically, the only really major exodus of Americans to Canada was during the Vietnam War, and that was to avoid the draft. It was not because they didn't like who was president of the United States.
Yeah, that's real politic. What are you doing Tuesday night, Vaughn?
I'm going to be watching the election returns. This is the most fascinating. I've been watching American elections since Nixon versus Humphrey in 1968, and this is the most fascinating one, I would say, in modern times. Now, I say that as a spectator. Americans may be facing a different level of anxiety. A humor writer for the Victoria paper said, the American election is like, for a Canadian, is like watching a house party across the street that has gotten really out of hand. There's furniture coming through the windows, cop cars on the front lawn, and you're just hoping that the furor doesn't spread across the street to your side.
Well said. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer watching from across the street, across the border. Thank you, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Finally, if you've been watching the World Series on TV, you've seen the celebrity fans, right? Whooping it up in the box seats or behind home plate. Bill Murray, John Cusack, Eddie Vedder have all been cheering on the Cubs. But are they true fans or are they just on the bandwagon? The music site Pitchfork quotes Chicago and Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins saying, "Other Cubs celebrities tend to show up when the playoffs are around. I don't necessarily see them in June." Ooh, burn. That's right, Billy. Tonight, the Cubs and Indians play the final game at 5 o'clock our time. One of them will be champion, either the long-suffering Cubs or the long racist Indians, and you'll hear a fan from each team tell you why you should be pulling for their team tonight. That's later today on All Things Considered. Starts at 2 o'clock today on KUOW. But you're shy, you're gonna be right if you held yourself up to that.